He cried about her doing her homework in the toilet while the kitchen was full of strangers and her bedroom was out of bounds. He cried about other incidents from Bee's childhood as well, all of them from before he met her. It was as though different vintages of sadness were stored in different parts of his mind, stacked chronologically. And his tear ducts were on the end of electrical wires that didn't touch any recent decades, just went straight to the distant past. The Bee he wept for was a pretty little ghost conjured up from his wife's stash of photos and anecdotes, but no less pitiable for that. Toward the end of his weeping fit, he cried about the coin collection his father had given him. It was shop-bought but serious. A handsomely packaged starter set that included a French franc, an Italian lira, a 10-drachma bit, a German 50 pfennig with a woman planting a seedling on it, and other commonplace treasures, which, to a clueless boy, seemed like relics from an ancient epoch. The prehistoric empire of numismatics. Ah, happy innocence. But not long afterward, a school friend murmured in his ear, serpent-like, that this prissy little collection was not valuable at all, and persuaded him to swap the lot for a single coin that had been minted, he said, in 333 AD. It was misshapen and corroded, but it had a helmeted warrior engraved on it, and Peter fell under its spell. His father was furious when he found out. He kept saying, if genuine, in a fastidiously dubious tone, and lecturing Peter about the extreme commonness of Constantine copper coins, and how damaged this one was, and how the whole damn business of collecting was infested with fakery. Peter kept protesting hotly, "You weren't there," referring not just to the reign of Constantine, but also to the moment when a small, impressionable boy was defeated by a bigger, cleverer one. For years, that poisonous repetition of, "if genuine," festered in his mind, proof of everything that was creepy and cold about his father. By the time Peter was ready to understand that the quarrel was bluster, and that his dad had simply been hurt, the old man was in his grave. About all these things and more, Peter wept. Then he felt better, as if purged. His raw eyelids, which would have needed careful pampering if he'd been anywhere but here, were soothed by the oily moistness of the warm air. His head, which had started to pound toward the end of his crying jag, felt light and pleasantly anaesthetized.
"A very long song,"
said Jesus Lover 5, sitting with her back against the lectern. He hadn't noticed her arrive. This wasn't the first time she'd come to the church to visit him at an hour when most others of her kind were sleeping. "Why aren't you in bed?" he asked, heaving himself up on one elbow. He could barely see her. The entire church was lit with nothing more powerful than a couple of oil flames floating in ceramic soup bowls, toy braziers.
"Awake,"
she said, as if that explained everything. Perhaps it did. He replayed her comment in his head. A very long song. Evidently, to her, his weeping sounded no different from singing. The distress in his voice was lost in translation. She heard only the horn-like music of whimpering, the rhythm of sobs. Maybe she would have liked to join in, but couldn't make out any words.
"I was remembering things from long ago," he explained.
"Long ago,"
she echoed. Then,
"long ago, the Lord said to Israel, 'I have loved you, my people.'"
The quote from Jeremiah surprised him. Not because she had managed to memorize it, but because it was from a more modern translation than the King James, the New Living, if he wasn't mistaken. Did Kurtzberg pick and choose between different Bibles? In the King James, long ago was of old,
while the original Hebrew meant something more like from afar. Long ago and far away. Maybe they were the same thing after all. Rousing himself from his scholarly fog, he opened his mouth to ask Jesus' lover 5 why she had quoted that bit of scripture, what it meant to her. But lover 5's head was slumped onto her chest. Whatever the reason for her insomnia at home in her own bed, she had found sleep here with him. It was during his second sojourn with the Oasens also that Peter experienced his first death. His first dead Oasen, that is. He still had no clear idea of the size of the settlement's population, but was inclined to think it might be a few thousand, and that the Jesus lovers represented only a tiny minority of the souls living in this great hive of dwellings. Birth and death must surely be going on as normal inside those amber walls, the same as in any other big town. But he had no access to it until, one day, Jesus Lover 1 came and told him that his mother had died.
"My mother," he announced. "Dead."
"Oh, I'm so sorry," said Peter, instinctively putting his arms around Lover 1. He could tell at once that it was the wrong thing to do, like embracing a woman who absolutely doesn't want to be touched by anyone other than her husband. Lover 1's shoulders cringed, his body stiffened, his arms trembled, his face turned away lest it brush against Peter's chest. Peter released him and stepped back in embarrassment. "Your mother," he blurted. "What an awful loss." Lover 1 gave this notion some deliberation before responding.
"Mother made me,"
he said at last.
"If mother never be, I never be also. Mother never very important man.
Woman.
Woman, yes."
A few more seconds passed. "When did she die?" asked Peter. Again there was a pause. Oasens had difficulty choosing the linguistic boxes into which they felt obliged, by others, to put their conceptions of time.
"Before you came."
"Before I came to Oasis?"
"Before you came with word in hand."
"Last few days, then. Maybe even yesterday. Is she, has there been a funeral?"
"Few."
"Have you put her in the ground?"
"Soon,"
said Jesus Lover 1, with a pacifying motion of the glove, as if giving his solemn promise that the procedure would be attended to as soon as it was feasible.
"After the harvest."
"After the, Lover 1 searched his vocabulary for a pronounceable alternative.
"The reaping."
Peter nodded, although he didn't really understand. He guessed that this reaping must be the harvest of one of the Oasens' food crops. A job so time-sensitive and labor-intensive that the community simply couldn't fit a funeral into their schedule. The old lady would have to wait. He imagined a wizened, slightly smaller version of Lover 1 nestled motionless in her bed, one of those cots that already so closely resembled a coffin. He imagined the fluffy wisps of bedding being wrapped around her like a cocoon, in preparation for her burial. As it turned out, there was no need to guess or imagine. Lover 1, speaking in the same tone he might have used to invite a guest to see a notable monument or tree, if this place had had such things as monuments and trees, invited him to come and see the body of his mother. Peter tried and failed to think of a suitable reply. "Good idea, thank you," and "I'd like that." All felt wrong somehow. Instead, in silence, he put on his yellow boots. It was a brilliant morning, and the shade inside his church ill-prepared him for the dazzling sunshine. He accompanied Jesus Lover One across the scrubland to the compound, taking 2 steps for every 3 or 4 of the oases. He was learning many things on this visit, and how to amble was one of them. There was an art to walking slower than your instinct told you to, keeping pace with a much smaller person, yet not appearing exasperated or clumsy. The trick was to pretend you were wading through waist-deep water, watched by a judge who would award you points for poise. Side by side, they reached Jesus Lover One's house. It looked identical to all the others, and had not been adorned with any flags, accoutrements, or painted messages proclaiming an inhabitant's death. A few people were walking around nearby, no more than normal, and they were getting on with business as usual, as far as Peter could tell. Lover One led him around the back of the building, to the patch of ground where clothing was washed and hung, and where children often played with chichwachihwa, the Oasin equivalent of bool, soft dark balls made of compacted moss. Today, there were no children or chichwachihwa, and the washing line strung between 2 houses was bare. The yard was given over to Jesus Lover One's mother. Peter gazed at the small body lying uncushioned and uncovered on the ground. It had been stripped of its robe. This alone would have made Peter unable to tell whether he'd known this person or not, as he was still dependent, to a shameful degree, on fabric color. But even if he'd managed to remember some distinctive aspect of this creature's physiognomy, some variation in skin texture or the shape of facial bulges, it wouldn't have helped now, as the body was obscured under a shimmering, shivering layer of insects. He looked aside at Jesus Lover One, to gauge how alarmed he should be at this nightmarish spectacle. Maybe when Lover One had set off earlier this morning, the corpse had been free of parasites and they'd all seized their opportunity in his absence. If so, Lover One didn't seem perturbed by the swarm. He contemplated the insects as calmly as if they were flowers on a shrub. Admittedly, these bugs were every bit as beautiful as flowers. They had iridescent wings, glossy carapaces of lavender and yellow. Their buzz was musical. They covered almost every inch of flesh, giving the corpse the appearance of a twitching, breathing effigy.
"Your mother,"
Peter began, lost for further words.
"My mother gone,"
said Jesus Lover One.
"Only her body remain."
Peter nodded, striving to hide the queasy fascination provoked in him by the insect horde. Lover One's philosophical attitude to the situation was perfectly sound. It was what Peter himself would have tried to persuade him to feel, had Lover One been terribly distraught. But the fact that Lover One wasn't terribly distraught, or didn't appear to be, confused Peter. It was one thing to deliver a funeral address to a bunch of unbelieving USIG workers, urging them to regard the body merely as a vehicle for the immortal soul. It was quite another thing to be standing next to someone who'd taken that principle so deeply to heart that they could watch their own mother's body being overrun with insects. Peter's eyes were drawn to one of the woman's feet. The bugs, in their restless fidgeting, had exposed the toes. There were 8 of them, very small and narrow. He'd assumed, because the Oasins were 5-fingered, that they'd be 5-toed too. The mistakenness of that assumption made him realize how far he had to go before he truly understood these people.
"Forgive me for not remembering, Lover One," said Peter. "But did I ever meet your mother before today?"
"Never,"
Lover One replied.
"Walk from here to our church. To far."
Peter wondered whether this was an ironic comment, implying that she'd never summoned up sufficient motivation to visit, or whether it literally meant she'd been too weak or ill to walk the distance. Most likely, it was literal.
"My mother begin, only begin, to know Jesus,"
Lover One explained. He made a gesture in the air, gently rotating his hand to indicate slow, stumbling progress.
Every day, we carry your watch away from church in our hands, and we bring them to home. Every day, watch go in her like food. Every day, she come more near to the Lord.
And he turned his face in the direction of Peter's church, as if watching his mother walk there after all. In the days that followed, Peter learned what was really meant by the harvest. He realized that Jesus' lover one's reason for fetching him to see the corpse had nothing to do with emotions. It was educative. The alighting of the bugs on the flesh was just the first step in an industrious husbandry managed by the Oasens in every detail. The body, Peter learned, had been painted with a poison which intoxicated the bugs, so that when they'd finished laying eggs, they were semi-conscious, unable to fly. The Oasens then collected them and, with great care, pulled them to bits. The legs and wings, when ground up and dried, made a fearsomely potent seasoning. One pinch could flavor a vat of food. The bodies yielded a rich nectar, which was mixed with water and white flour to make honey, or processed into a vivid yellow dye. And while various members of the Oasen community were busy transforming the insects' remains into useful materials, the insects' eggs were busy hatching. Peter was fetched at regular intervals to witness how things were getting on. Like most people he'd ever known, except for one frankly balmy biology teacher at school, Peter was not very keen on maggots. Wise and practical though it might be to accept the naturalness of death and decay, the sight of those opportunistic little larvae always disgusted him. But the maggots on the body of Jesus' lover one's mother were like nothing he'd ever seen before. They were calm and fat, rice white, each the size of a large fruit pip. There were many thousands of them, densely packed and pearlescent, and if you stared at them long enough, they didn't look like maggots at all, but like a cornucopia of albino raspberries. These too, the Oasens harvested. When at last the body of Jesus' lover one's mother had yielded all the bounty it was going to yield, she lay exhausted on the ground, in the shade of a couple of gently swaying garments that hung on the washing line nearby. Since she was the only Oasen Peter had seen completely naked, he had no way of telling how much of the grotesquerie he saw before him was due to decay, and how much of it was what he would have found under the clothing of any healthy living Oasen. Her flesh, which smelled fermented but not foul, had turned grey as clay and was pitted with pox and cavities. She had no breasts or anything else suggesting human femaleness or maleness. The paradigm he had in his head, based on photographs of human corpses in famines and concentration camps, was of flesh shrunk down to a thin parchment of skin to hold the bones together. That wasn't what confronted him here. Lover One's mother apparently had no ribs, no skeleton, just solid flesh that was liquefying. The holes, eaten into her arms and legs, exposed a ribbed black substance like licorice. Monster was the word that came to his mind as he suppressed a shudder. But then, creatura, created thing, he reminded himself.
Now we put her in the ground,
said Lover One on the third day. There was no urgency or ceremonial portent in his voice, nor was it clear what he meant by now. As far as Peter was aware, no grave had been dug, and there was no evidence of the community preparing for a solemn ritual. Would you like me to say something? Suggested Peter. At the funeral.
Funeral?
It's the custom of our... he began. Then, when Christians... he began again. Then, where I come from, when a person dies and is being buried, someone usually makes a speech before the body is put into the ground. They talk about the person who's died, and they try to remind his friends and family about what made that person special. Lover One bowed his head in courtesy.
You never know my mother,
he pointed out, with stunkingly obvious good sense. That's true, Peter conceded. But you could tell me some things about her, and I could turn those things into a speech. Even as he made the offer, it seemed absurd.
What can make no change in my mother now?
Said Lover One. Words can comfort the friends and family left behind, said Peter. Would you like me to read from the book? Jesus Lover One smoothed his hands over an invisible molehill in the air, signalling that this would not be necessary.
Could Spock give us what from the book long before?
And he recited them for Peter's approval. A trickle of lisping nonsense entered Peter's ears. It took him a few seconds to replay the meaningless symbols and translate them into a Bible verse. A verse which, in fact, was not from the Bible, but from the Book of Common Prayer.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
For several dozen hours after this incident, Peter lived in fear that some generous soul would bring him, as a special treat, a dish made from maggots. The Oasens were always bringing him snacks, and who knows, they might think he was getting fed up with white flour. Surprise dessert for Father Peter! He knew his revulsion was irrational, as the food would no doubt be delicious and probably very good for him too. Moreover, he was aware that every country had its culinary challenges, which provoked disgust in squeamish foreigners. The Japanese with their giant fish eyeballs and cod semen and still squirming octopus. The Africans with their goat heads. The Chinese with their bird's nest soup that was really saliva, and so on. If he'd been ministering in any of these places, chances were he'd be honoured with one of these specialities. Wasn't there even an Italian cheese that was rotten and maggot-infested? Kazumazu, it was called. Amazing how he could retrieve that term, which he probably read just once in a magazine years ago, when only yesterday he'd blanked on the name of the street where he lived. Of course, he'd never had to eat any of these outlandish substances. All of his ministries, until now, had been in England. The most exotic thing he'd ever been served, at an outreach convention in Bradford, had been caviar. And his problem hadn't been the fish eggs themselves, but the money that the organisers had channelled into the catering when they were supposed to be raising funds for the city's homeless. Anyway, this wasn't about maggots per se. It was about the vivid memory of Jesus Lover One's mother and the unerasable emotionally charged connection between her and the maggots that had fed on her. His mind boggled at how her own son could bear to eat a foodstuff that had been produced in this way. To this question, as with so many others, God organized a very specific and enlightening answer. Jesus Lover One showed up at the church one evening carrying a hamper of food. Wordlessly, he unpacked it in front of Peter as they sat down together on the bed behind the pulpit. The food smelled wholesome and was still warm. It was white flour soup in its mushroom guise, and several hunks of white flour bread with brown crusts and pale insides, fresh from the oven. I'm glad it's white flour, Peter said, deciding to be totally frank. I was worried you would bring me something made from the creatures you harvested from your mother's body. I don't think I could eat that. Lover One nodded.
I also. Other can. Not I.
Peter absorbed the words, but couldn't interpret their meaning. Maybe Lover One was informing him of the etiquette governing this particular ritual. Or was it an open-hearted disclosure? Tell me more, he thought. But he knew from experience that keeping silent in the hope that an oasis would fill the silence didn't work. It's a very good and admirable idea, he said, to do what you people do with someone who's just died. He wasn't sure how to go on. The bottom line was that no amount of admiration could prevent him being disgusted. If he put that into words, he'd be lecturing Lover One on the irreconcilable differences between their species. Again, Lover One nodded.
We do all things to make food. Make food for many.
A bowl of soup sat balanced in the lap of his tunic. He'd eaten none of it yet. I've been dreaming of your mother, Peter confessed. I didn't know her as a person. I'm not saying... He took a deep breath. The sight of her covered in insects and then in maggots, and everyone just... He looked down at Lover One's boots, even though there was no possibility of eye-to-eye confrontation anyway. I'm not used to it. It upset me. Lover One sat unmoving. One gloved hand rested on his abdomen, the other held a piece of bread.
I also, he said.
I thought, I got the impression you, all of you, were afraid of death, continued Peter. And yet...
We fear death,
Lover One affirmed.
However, fear cannot hold life in a body when life is over. Nothing can hold life in a body. Only the Lord God.
Peter stared straight into the unreadable face of his friend. There can be moments in a person's life, he suggested, when grief over the loss of a loved one is stronger than faith. Lover One waited a long time before responding. He ate a few spoonfuls of the soup, which was now cold, thick and congealed. He ate some bread, tearing off small pieces and inserting them gently into the lipless, toothless hole in his head.
My mother, very important woman,
he said at last,
for me.
In this second sojourn among the Oasens, God took care to keep Peter's experiences in balance. His first death was followed, not too long afterward, by his first birth. A woman called Chachalu, not a Jesus lover, evidently, was having a baby. And Peter was invited to the delivery. Jesus Lover One, his escort, implied that this was a great honor. It was certainly a surprise, because he'd never been formally acknowledged by the settlement's unbelievers. But this was an event so joyous that the usual reticence was put aside, and the entire Oasen community was united in hospitality. The contrast between the death and the birth was striking. Whereas the body of Lover One's mother had lain unattended in a backyard, mourned by no one except her son, left in solitude to attract insects, then treated as if it was nothing more than a vegetable patch, the woman who was about to give birth was the focus of an enormous amount of fuss. The streets leading to the house were remarkably busy, and everyone seemed to be heading for the same place. When Peter first saw the house, he thought it had caught fire, but the vapor wafting out of the windows was incense. Inside, the expectant mother was not laying in a bed surrounded by medical equipment, or suffering the trials of labor under the supervision of a midwife, but walking around freely, socializing. dressed in a snow-white variant of the Oasen's usual attire, looser, thinner, more like a nightgown, she held court, accepting visitors' congratulations one by one. Peter couldn't tell if she was happy or anxious, but she was obviously not in pain, nor could he detect any swelling in her trim little body. Her gestures were elegant and formalized, like a medieval dance, with a whole host of partners. This was Chachalu's big day. Peter knew that the Oasens didn't celebrate marriages. Their sexual pairings were private arrangements, so discreet as to be seldom alluded to. But the day of childbirth was a flagrantly public highlight in a woman's life, a ritual exhibition every bit as extravagant as a wedding party. Chachalu's house was heaving with well-wishers. Dozens of bustling bodies dressed in bright colors. All the pencils in the aquarelle set, thought Peter, as he strove to discern the difference between one robe and another. Vermilion, coral, apricot, copper, cerise, salmon. Those were just some of the pinks he could put a name to. Others were beyond his vocabulary. Across the room, weaving through the crowd, a person clad in pale violet was reunited with an old acquaintance clad in unripe plum. And only when they touched each other, glove to arm, did Peter see that the two robes which he would otherwise have perceived as identical in color were in fact unique. And so it went on. All over the house, people greeting each other, waving at each other, needing no more than a glance to know and be known. In the midst of this easily intimate hubbub, Peter appreciated that he would need to develop a whole new relationship with color if he was ever to recognize more than a couple of dozen individuals among this city's multitudes. It was a lovely party, Peter might have said, if he'd been asked to describe it for someone who wasn't there. The only problem was, he felt surplus to requirements. Jesus Lover One had ushered him in, but kept meeting up with friends who drew him into conversations which, to Peter's ears, were just gargles and wheezes. Asking for translations seemed rude, and in any case, there was no reason to suppose that a stranger would understand much of what was being discussed. For a while he felt oafishly out of place, towering over everyone here, literally casting a shadow over them, and yet, irrelevant. But then he relaxed and began to enjoy himself. This gathering wasn't about him. That was actually the beauty of it. He was privileged to observe, but he wasn't on duty. Nothing was expected of him. He was, for the first time since coming to Oasis, a tourist. So, he sat on his haunches in a corner of the room, allowed the bluish fog of incense to go to his head, and watched the expectant mother being garlanded with affection. After what felt like hours of meeting and greeting, Chachalu abruptly signaled that she'd had enough. Exhaustion had apparently overcome her, and she sat on the floor, surrounded by a puddle of her gown's white cloth. Her friends backed away as she pulled the hood off her head, revealing livid flesh sheened with sweat. She bent her head between her knees as though she was about to faint or vomit. Then the fontanelle in her head yawned open, and a large pink mass bulged out, glistening with frothy white lather. Peter jerked back in shock, convinced he was witnessing a violent death. One more convulsion, and it was over. The baby was disgorged in a slithery spasm, sliding into the mother's waiting arms. Chachalu raised her head high, her fontanelle puckering shut, the fleshy kernels of her face still livid. The whole room erupted in a waffle of applause, and a mass of voices joined forces to make an eerie cooing sound, as loud as a chord pumped out of a cathedral organ. The baby was alive and well, already squirming to be released from its mother's grasp. It had no umbilical cord, and looked amazingly unlike a fetus. Instead, it was a perfect miniature person, its arms, legs, and head all in adult proportion. And, like a newborn horse or calf, it immediately tried to stand on its legs, figuring out the knack of balance even while its feet were still slippery with placental goo. The crowd applauded and cheered some more. Chachalu ceremoniously acknowledged the ovation, then set about cleaning the gunge off a child's flesh with a damp cloth.
charisma,
she announced. Another great cheer went up.
What did she say? Peter asked Lover One.
Charisma,
said Lover One. Is that the baby's name?
Name, yes,
said Lover One. Does that name have a meaning, or is it just a name?
Name have a meaning,
Lover One replied. Then, after a few seconds,
hope.
The child now stood firmly balanced on the floor, its arms stretched out like unfledged wings. Hananu sponged the last of the muck off its skin, whereupon someone emerged from the crowd with an armful of soft offerings. A robe, booties, gloves, all in dusky mauve, all tailored exactly to size. Together, Hananu and the gift-bearer, who might have been a grandmother or aunt, began to dress the infant, who tottered and swayed, but did not resist. When the job was done, the child was exquisitely smart and adorable, serenely content to be on display. A male, Peter decided. Unbelievable, the craftsmanship that had gone into those minuscule gloves. Each finger snug and velvety. Extraordinary how the child accepted this second skin. By this time, Peter was no longer squatting. His legs had begun to ache, and he'd stood up to stretch them. The baby, wondrously alert, took the measure of all the creatures in the room, an array of virtual replicas of himself. There was only one creature that didn't fit the picture. Only one creature that made no sense in his freshly configured view of the universe. Head tilting back, the child stood arrested, mesmerized by the alien. Hananu, noticing her son's quandary, likewise turned her attention to Peter. She called across the room. What does she say? Peter asked Lover One.
What?
Said Lover One.
What from you?
You mean a speech?
Lover One inclined his head diplomatically.
Few what? Many what? Any what you can.
But she's not, She's not a Jesus lover, is she?
No,
conceded Lover One, while Hananu made an urgent gesture to speed up Peter's compliance.
On this day, all what are good.
And he touched Peter's elbow, which, by Lover One standards, was tantamount to a shove. So there it was. He was an accessory, a bonus performance to enhance the mother's big day. Okay, nothing wrong with that. Christianity was used for such purposes all the time, and who knows, maybe it wasn't even his status as a pastor that this woman wanted to exploit, but his status as a visitor. He stepped forward. Phrases and themes tumbled around in his brain, but one thing was clear. He wanted this speech to be for the benefit of Lover One, so dignified in his bereavement, as much as for the mother and child. Often in his past ministries, he'd had a sudden insight into a staunch member of his congregation, a member who was constantly declaring the joy of knowing Christ, the bountiful blessings of faith, but who was, Peter would realize in a flash, achingly, inconsolably sad. Jesus Lover One might well be one of those souls.
I've been asked to speak, he said. To a few of you, what I say will have meaning. To most of you, maybe not. One day, I hope to speak your language. But wait, did you hear it? I just spoke that wonderful word, hope. The name of a feeling, and also the name of this child who has come to live with us today.
The baby lifted first one boot, then the other, and toppled backward. His mother caught him smoothly and eased him to the floor, where he sat in apparent thought.
Hope is a fragile thing, Peter continued, as fragile as a flower. Its fragility makes it easy to sneer at by people who see life as a dark and difficult ordeal. People who get angry when something they can't believe in themselves gives comfort to others. They prefer to crush the flower underfoot, as if to say, "See how weak this thing is. See how easily it can be destroyed." But in truth, hope is one of the strongest things in the universe. Empires fall, civilizations vanish into dust, but hope always comes back, pushing up through the ashes, growing from seeds that are invisible and invincible. The congregation, if you could be so bold as to call it that, was hushed, as if considering the import of each word, although they must surely be quite lost. He knew he should regard his speech as a kind of music, a brief burst of melody from a foreign guest invited to demonstrate an exotic instrument. "The most cherished of hopes, as we all know," he said, "is a new child. The Bible, the book that some of you love as much as I do, contains many fine stories about the birth of children, including the birth of Jesus, our Lord. But this is not the time and place for me to tell Bible stories. All I will say is that the ancient words of Ecclesiastes have helped me make sense of what I've seen in the last few days. Ecclesiastes says, 'To everything there is a season. There is a time to be born and a time to die, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to plant seeds and a time to reap. An old person, the mother of Jesus, lover one, has died. That was a very sad thing. A new person, Shuishua, has been born today. That is a very happy thing. Let us honor the equal importance of each. In celebrating a new life, we remember losing those who've left us. And then in the midst of sadness, our spirits are lifted as we welcome new life. So, to little Shuishua, most beautiful and precious gift to our community, I say, welcome." He hoped he'd invested the last word with sufficient resonance to signal that this was the end of his speech. Evidently, he had. The audience emitted a mass murmur, applauded and waved. Even the baby, catching the prevailing mood, extended his tiny gloves. The room, so hushed in the preceding minutes, was once again filled with cooing and conversation. The people who'd briefly been transformed into an audience turned back into a crowd. Peter bowed and retreated to his former spot against the wall. For one instant, in the midst of the renewed celebrations that followed, his mind was tickled by a thought of his own baby, growing inside the body of his wife far away. But it was just a thought, and not even a properly formed thought. A half-glimpsed reflection of a thought which couldn't compete with all the commotion right in front of him. The brightly dressed crowd, the excited gestures, the unearthly cries, the watchful newborn with its spindly limbs, hero of the moment, king of the day. Chapter 16. Toppling off an axis, falling through space. On the fifth day, a day of rain and almost unbearable beauty, it slipped Peter's mind that Granger was coming for him. It wasn't that he didn't want her to come, and it wasn't that she ceased to be real to him. Every now and then during the 360-odd hours leading up to their scheduled rendezvous, she had been in his thoughts. He wondered, for example, if she would let him help her with her next drug delivery. He recalled the scars on her forearms and speculated about what anguish might have led her younger self to inflict them. And sometimes, at nights before drifting off, he replayed a fleeting vision of her pale, troubled face. However, his life here among the Oasens was very full, and there were so many things he must try to hold in his head. "Observe the opportunity," as Ecclesiastes urged him. "Be not ignorant of anything great or small." Oh, he didn't forget to pray for Charlie Granger and Coretta, and he thought of Granger each time he did so. But when he woke up on the morning of the fifth day, the long night was finished, the sun had risen, and the rains were drawing near. and that was that. His appointment with Usyk's moody pharmacist was erased from his brain. Keeping track of schedules had never been his strong suit anyhow. The longer he spent among the Oasens, the less point he could see in clinging to ways of telling time that were, frankly, irrelevant. A day for him had ceased to feel like 24 hours, and it certainly didn't consist of 1,440 minutes. A day was a span of daylight, divided from the next by a spell of darkness. While the sun shone, he would stay awake for 20, maybe 25 hours at a stretch. He didn't know exactly how long, because his father's watch had stopped working, ruined by damp. Sad, but there was no point grieving. Anyway, life wasn't about measurement. It was about getting the most out of each God-given minute. There was so much to do, so much to digest, so many people to commune with. When darkness fell, Peter would slip into a comatose sleep, his consciousness sinking fast and irretrievable like a car dumped in a lake. After an age spent down on the bottom, he would float up into shallower fathoms where he would doze and dream, get up to pee, then doze and dream some more. It was as though he discovered the secret of Joshua. Joshua the cat, that is. The secret of snoozing for hours and days on end without boredom, storing up energy for a future occasion. And then, when he'd slept as much as he possibly could, he would lie awake, staring up at the sky, familiarizing himself with the 87 stars, giving them each a name. Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, Shua, Sheba, and so on. All those genealogies in Genesis and Exodus had come in useful after all. They had begat a new constellation. Mostly, by the light of slow-burning resin candles, he would sit up in bed, working on his paraphrases of Scripture. The King James Bible spread open on his lap, a notepad cradled on his forearm, a pillow for his head whenever he needed to mull over the alternatives. Unto every province according to the writing thereof, and unto every people after their language, Mordechai's publishing manifesto, sometime during the Israelites' Babylonian exile. If the Oasens couldn't have the gospel in their own words, they deserved the next best thing, a version they could speak and sing. More than once, he'd walked out from his church into the darkness, knelt in the area of scrubland where he buried his feces, and asked God to tell him honestly if he was falling prey to the sin of pride. These translations he was spending so much energy on, were they really needed? The Oasens had never asked to be delivered from consonants. They seemed resigned to their humiliation. Kurtzberg had taught them to sing Amazing Grace, and how sweet the sound had been. Yet, how excruciating, too. And wasn't that the point? There was grace in their strenuous approximation. More grace, for sure, than you'd find in some complacent congregation in a British village, singing facile hymns while their minds were half preoccupied with football or soap operas. The Oasens wanted their book of strange new things. Maybe he shouldn't dilute its strangeness. He prayed for guidance. God did not caution him. In the stillness of the balmy Oasen night, with the stars shining greenish in the azure heavens, the overwhelming message he felt in the atmosphere around him was, "All shall be well. Goodwill and compassion can never be wrong. Continue as you began." Nothing could tarnish the memory of the day when the Oasens sang Amazing Grace for him. It was Kurtzberg's gift to them, which they'd passed on to their next pastor. But he, Peter, would give them different gifts. He would give them scripture that flowed forth from them as easily as breath itself. Close to 120 Jesus lovers were in the fold now, and Peter was determined to know them all as individuals, which took a lot more effort than simply keeping a mental record of robe colors and Jesus lover numbers. He was making headway, so to speak, with telling the difference between the faces. The trick was to quit waiting for the features to resolve themselves into a nose, lips, ears, eyes, and so on. That wasn't going to happen. Instead, you had to decode a face as you decode a tree or a rock formation. Abstract, unique, but after you'd live with it for a while, familiar. Even so, to recognize was not the same as to know. You could train yourself to identify a certain pattern of bulge and color and realize this is Jesus Lover 13. But who really was Jesus Lover 13? Peter had to admit he was finding it difficult to know the Oasens in any deeper sense. He loved them. For the time being, that would have to do. Sometimes he wondered if it would have to do forever. It was hard to remember individuals if they didn't behave like humans, with their circus displays of ego, their compulsive efforts to brand themselves on your mind. Oasens didn't work that way. No one engaged in behaviors that screamed, "Look at me," or "Why won't the world let me be myself?" No one, as far as he could tell, was anxiously pondering the question, "Who am I?" They just got on with life. At first, he'd found that impossible to believe, and assumed this equanimity must be a front. And any day now, he would discover that the Oasens were as screwed up as anyone else. But no, they were as they appeared to be. In one way, it was really kind of restful to be spared the melodramas that made things so complicated when you dealt with other humans. But it meant that his tried and true method of gaining intimacy with new acquaintances was totally useless here. He and B had pulled it off so many times, in all the places where they'd ministered, from opulent hotel lobbies to needle exchanges, always the same message to open people up. "Don't worry, I can see that you're not like everybody else. Don't worry, I can see that you're special." The Oasens didn't need Peter to tell them who they were. They bore their individuality with modest self-confidence, neither celebrating nor defending the eccentricities and flaws that distinguish them from others of their kind. They were like the most Buddhist-y Buddhists imaginable, which made their hunger for the Christian religion all the more miraculous. "You're aware, aren't you," he'd said to Jesus Lover One a while back, "that some of my people believe in different religions from the Christian one?"
"We have heard,"
Lover One replied. "Would you like me to tell you something about those religions?" It seemed a decent thing to offer. Lover One did the fidgety thing with the sleeves of his robe that he always did when he wanted a conversation to go no further.
"We will have no other God than God our Savior. In Him alone we have hope of life."
It was what any Christian pastor might yearn to hear from a new convert. Yet hearing it stated so boldly, so calmly, was a bit unsettling. Ministering to the Oasens was a joy, but Peter couldn't help thinking that it was too easy. Or was it? Why shouldn't it be easy? When the window of the soul was clear, not smeared and tarnished with the accumulated muck of deviousness and egomania and self-loathing, there was nothing to stop the light from shining straight in. Yes, maybe that was it. Or maybe the Oasens were just too naive, too impressionable, and it was his responsibility to give their faith some intellectual rigor. He hadn't worked it out yet. He was still praying on it. Then there were the ones who weren't Jesus lovers, the ones whose names he couldn't even pronounce. What was he to do about them? They were no less precious in the eyes of God, and no doubt had needs and sorrows every bit as serious as anyone else's. He should be reaching out to them, but they ignored him. Not aggressively. They just behaved as if he wasn't there. No, that wasn't quite right. They acknowledged his presence as one might respect a fragile obstacle, a plant that mustn't be stepped on, a chair that mustn't be knocked over. But they had nothing to say to him. Because, of course, they literally had nothing to say to him, nor he to them. Determined to do more than just preach to the converted, Peter strove to get to know these strangers, noting the nuances of their gestures, the way they related to each other, the roles they seemed to play in the community, which, in a community as egalitarian as the Oasens, was not easy. There were days when he felt the best he'd ever achieved with them was a sort of animal tolerance. The kind of relationship that an occasional visitor develops with a cat, which, after a while, no longer hisses and hides. Altogether, there were about a dozen non-Christians he recognized on sight, and whose mannerisms he felt he was getting a grip on. As for the Jesus lovers, he knew them all. He kept notes on them, indecipherable notes, scrawled sometimes in the dark, smudged with sweat and humidity, qualified with question marks in the margins. It didn't matter. The real practical knowledge was intuitive, stored in what he liked to think of as the oasis side of his brain. He still had no clear idea how many people lived in C2. The houses had many rooms, like beehives, and he couldn't guess how many of them were inhabited, which meant he also couldn't estimate how tiny, or not so tiny, the proportion of Christians was. Maybe 1%. Maybe 0.1%. He just didn't know. Still, even 100 Christians was an amazing achievement in a place like this. More than enough to accomplish great things. The church was coming ahead. The building, that is. It had a roof now, sensibly sloped, watertight, and utilitarian. His polite requests for a spire had been deflected.
"We do all other thing, please, before."
He sensed that they would deflect it forever. As a compensation, the Oasens had promised to decorate the ceiling. Kurtzberg had once shown them a photograph of a place they called, almost unintelligibly, the Chichgen Chapel. Inspired by the handiwork of Michelangelo, the Oasens were keen to create something similar, except they suggested that all the incidents should be from the life of Jesus, rather than from the Old Testament. Peter was all for it. Apart from giving the church some much-needed colour, it would give him an insight into the unique nature of these people's perception. Lover 5, as always, was quickest off the mark, showing him her sketch of the scene she proposed to paint. It was the one outside Jesus' tomb, where Salome and the two Marys find the stone rolled away. Evidently, this story was already familiar to her. Peter couldn't guess which of the four gospel accounts Kurtzberg had used, whether it was Luke's two men in dazzling raiment story, Matthew's angel descending from heaven with earthquake accompaniment, Mark's lone young man sitting on a rock, or John's pair of angels inside the tomb. Whichever it was, Lover 5 had rejected these characters and replaced them with the risen Christ. Her mourners, daintily proportioned and clad in hooded robes like herself, confronted a scarecrow-thin figure wearing a loincloth. This Jesus stood erect with arms spread wide, an eye-shaped hole in each palm of his starfish-shaped hands. Above his neck, where his head should be, Lover 5 had left a blank space surrounded by a porcupine profusion of lines, to indicate radiance from an incandescent light source. On the ground between him and the women lay a bagel-like object, which Peter realized after a minute must be the discarded crown of thorns.
"No longer dead,"
Lover 5 explained. Or maybe that was the title of her drawing. Lover 5 may have been the first with her sketch, but she was not the first to get a painting mounted on the church ceiling. That distinction belonged to Jesus Lover 63, an extremely shy individual who communicated mainly in gestures, even among his, her, own people. The Oasens were scrupulous in their respect for others, and gossip was not their style. But Peter gradually got the message that Lover 63 was disfigured or malformed in some way. Nothing specific was said, only a general sense that Lover 63 was a pathetic character, soldiering on as though he was normal when everyone could see he wasn't. Peter tried his best, without staring, to see what the problem might be. He noted that the flesh of Lover 63's face appeared less raw, less glistening than other people's. It looked as if he had been dusted with talc, or briefly cooked, like fresh chicken whose pinkness fades to white after a few seconds in boiling water. In Peter's eyes, this made him, if anything, a little easier to behold. But to his neighbours, it was evidence of a pitiable disability. Whatever Lover 63's handicap was, it didn't affect his artistic skill. His painted panel, already affixed to the church ceiling directly above the pulpit, was the sole finished contribution so far, and any subsequent offerings would have to be impressive indeed to equal its quality. It glowed like a stained glass skylight, and had an uncanny ability to remain visible, even when the sun was on the wane and the church's interior grew dim, as though the pigments were luminescent in their own right. It combined bold expressionist colours with the intricate, exquisitely balanced composition of the medieval altarpiece. The figures were approximately half life-size, crowded onto a rectangle of velvety cloth that was bigger than Jesus Lover 63. His choice of biblical scene was Thomas the Doubter's meeting with his fellow disciples when they tell him they've seen Jesus, a most unusual subject to tackle. Peter was almost certain that no Christian painter had ever attempted it before. Compared to the more sensational finger-in-the-wound encounter with the resurrected Christ, this earlier episode was devoid of visual drama. An ordinary man in an ordinary room voices his skepticism about what a bunch of other ordinary men have just told him. But in Lover 63's conception, it was spectacular. The disciples' robes, all in different colours, of course, were scorched with tiny black crucifixes, as though a barrage of laser beams from the radiant Christ had sizzled brands onto their clothing. Speech bubbles issued from their slitty mouths, like trails of vapour. Inside each bubble was a pair of disembodied hands, in the same starfish design as Lover 5 had used. And in the centre of each starfish, the eye-shaped hole, adorned with an impasto glob of pure crimson, which could either be a pupil or a drop of blood. Thomas's robe was monochrome, unmarked, and his speech bubble was a sober brown. It contained no hands, no images of any kind, only a screed of calligraphy, incomprehensible but elegant, like Arabic. "This is very beautiful," Peter had said to Jesus Lover 63 when the painting was formally delivered. Lover 63 lowered his head. Assent, embarrassment, acknowledgement, pensiveness, pleasure, pain. Who knew? "It also reminds us of a very important truth about our faith," said Peter. "A truth that's especially important in a place like this, situated so very far away from where Christianity began." Lover 63 stooped lower still. Perhaps his head weighed too heavy on his neck. "Jesus allowed Thomas to put his finger into his wounds," said Peter, "because he understood that some people cannot believe without proof. It's a natural human response." Peter hesitated, wondering if the word human needed qualification, then decided it must be obvious by now that he regarded the Oasians as no less human than himself. But Jesus was aware that it would not be possible for everyone, everywhere, forever afterward, to see and touch him the way Thomas did. So he said, "Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed." And that's us, my friend. He laid a hand gingerly on Lover 63's shoulder. "You and me, and all of us here."
"Yes," said Lover 63.
For him, that constituted fulsome conversation. A group of other Jesus lovers, who'd accompanied him to the church for the delivery of the painting, made trembling motions with their shoulders. Peter realized that this was probably their equivalent of laughter. Laughter. So they did have a sense of humor after all. He was constantly learning important things of this kind, things which made him feel that the gulf between him and these people was growing shorter with every sunrise. Lover 63's painting was solemnly raised and affixed to the ceiling, inaugurating the church's devotional display. The next day, it was joined by Jesus Lover 20's interpretation of Mary Magdalene being purged of her seven devils. The devils, ectoplasmic vapours with vaguely feline shapes, exploded from her torso like fireworks, ignited by Jesus, who stood behind Mary in a spread-arm pose. It was a cruder piece of work than Lover 63's, but no less strong, and it too glowed with an unfeasible luminescence. The next day, no one brought a painting, but they did bring Peter a bed to replace the bundle of rags and nets he'd been sleeping on since his hammock had come down. The Oasens had accepted his hammock unquestioningly and would have been quite prepared to worship with it dangling in their midst. But Peter had cut it down when he judged the church was so close to finish now that the hammock marred its dignity. The Oasens, noting that their pastor did not necessarily require to hang suspended in order to be comfortable, had quietly constructed a bed for him, according to their usual bathtub coffin template, albeit larger, shallower, and less crammed with swaddly cotton. It was carried across the scrubland to the church, ushered through the door, and installed right behind the pulpit, without any pretense that it was anything other than a bed. During the first prayer meeting after its arrival, Peter joked that if he got too tired while speaking, he could always just fall backward and have a sleep. His congregation nodded indulgently. To them, it was a sensible idea.